confession, as I was trying to prepare for this lesson, it became increasingly obvious that I couldn't do what I wanted to do. So I kind of changed mid-course, and we're gonna try something a little different this morning. What my initial intent was is to cover the missionary activity in the 17th century. I don't think it's an understatement to say that missions, especially in the Catholic Church, exploded in the 17th century. And there's a number of reasons I think that's the case. But there was some in the Protestant Church, but not nearly as significant as it was in the Catholic Church. I think that comes later toward into the 18th century when the Protestant Church begins a lot more missionary activity. And I think something that I found strikingly interesting was the lack of success, if you would, in ultimately seeing the church expand into certain areas. So what I want to do this morning is I'm going to start with just, you know, none of us are missions majors. Some of us have been to Bible college and we've probably had some missions classes. And I'm sure all of us are acquainted with some missionaries and what their work is. But what I want to talk about is why? Why do we do missions? Let's just start there. Okay, where does God... Okay.
Share Christ with people.
Okay. To what end?
So that every tongue, tribe, and nation could glorify God.
Okay. And what is it in Let the Nations Be Glad? How does John Piper put it?
Missions exist because worship doesn't.
Right. Okay. And so the idea, at least from a biblical perspective, is that we want to add worshipers of God, of the one true God, just like we are. So let's talk a little bit about, and like I said, none of us are missionaries or missions majors. I mean, in that sense, but let's talk about some methodology. So let's say that you want to go to an indigenous tribe in North America and take the gospel to them. How would you go about doing that?
Tell people you want support.
Okay, you might start with trying to secure means to get there.
Probably be in a group. How do I want to be by yourself?
And I think we find, especially in the 17th century, that a lot of people were individuals. They didn't go as groups, but it might be helpful to have a group.
Well, I think it's even biblical because everybody went out in pairs.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if everybody, a lot of people did. I guess.
Okay.
Okay.
You would need to learn their language and their culture so that you're speaking on the same terms.
Okay.
The true gospel is what, you know, when you say God, what does that mean to them?
Right. Were you thinking something, Scott?
Well, I'm just trying to think of the bare minimum. A lot of things are helpful, like support and things like that. But I think the initiative to go, obviously, you have to have that. You have to be able to communicate with them, probably language. I don't know, what else would be like the bare minimum that you would need?
Yeah.
I would add on to that, you would need, I think, a thorough training of communicating, not just in language, but even in knowing the gospel very thoroughly. Because one of, I think, probably worse than having people who aren't unreached are people who are who have the gospel inaccurately spoken to them, because now they're opening in something that isn't true. In that case, if it's communicated unclearly, so I think there's a lot of preparation that has to go in before you can even go.
But even if we break that down to a bare minimum, at least a good understanding of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, basically, we're saying you would need a calling. You wouldn't want to just say, "Hey, I'm going to do this," just because it sounds like something interesting. You would want something that would indicate that God is actually calling you to do that. You might want to secure some kind of resources in order to do it. And when we think about the 17th century, and realizing that most people who were missionaries originated where?
Europe.
In Europe, right? And for the Catholic Church, it was primarily Portugal, Spain, Italy, although there were some from places like Belgium and Germany that went.
You probably want some kind of writing region, but you probably have to translate at some point.
Which is an interesting point, because, you know, there were missionaries that went to the Far East, and I think in some of those civilizations they actually had a written language. I don't know that any of the indigenous people in North America had a written language at that time. So we've got some difficulties here, right? Number one, do we understand the gospel, and can we communicate that clearly even in our own language? And now we've got people who don't understand our language, and we don't understand their language. So you've got a serious communication barrier there. Plus, there's no written language, so you've got to figure out how to do that, right? So once you get to the field and you have some, you've struggled, and it's going to be a period of time, obviously, probably years, before you develop the ability to communicate. What are the tools that you would think would be essential once you've seen some conversions? What would you want to have available to those people?
The Bible.
What?
The Bible.
The Bible? Why would you want them to have the Bible?
Because I want to share Christ.
Okay, but which Bible? I mean, we're talking about they don't have a written language. So what's going to happen? What, Fred? They're not, I mean, yeah, how would you get it to the point? So, there's another problem, right? I mean, you want them to have the Bible, because the Bible is the written word of God. But you're not only are you going to have to, I mean, unless you're going to always be reading it to them, you're going to have to teach them how to read. So, and that's something that I think is very interesting as I look through 17th century missions. And what I have here, these are not notes. These are just lists of dates and people. So, we're not going to do anything terribly exciting with this. One of the things that, I'll just let you start them. Pass them around, and I'll take these up here and pass them around.
about what they do believe.
And the
culture, because a lot of them believe in many gods, and you're trying to tell them there's one.
And that's an interesting point as well. It's, yeah, where are they, you know, where are they coming from? And even when we talk about evangelism, that's something that, you know, it's whether it's, you know, our neighbor or somebody that we meet on an airplane. One of the things that, you know, is helpful is to know where they're coming from. And in the United States, I mean, you could easily come across someone that's a totally different religion than Christianity. And knowing that and understanding that's probably going to help you a little bit with communicating the gospel, or at least, you know, where to begin with them. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Like when we went to Jamaica, they had all the lingo.
Yeah.
So when you were communicating them, we were not, and even though we were using the same words, we were not on the same page.
No, we were not. And that's an interesting point, yeah. So what I've done here, and this is just a flavor, and you can see just under the Jesuits, this is only the first quarter of the century. There's a whole lot more throughout the rest of the century as well. And back to my statement about these lessons, our intent is not to give you an intense amount of detail. I mean, we aren't interested in these dates. We aren't interested in these people necessarily. You're going to walk out of here. You're going to throw this piece of paper away, and most of these names and these dates will vanish from your memory, and that's okay. My intent here is maybe to whet your appetite. Maybe, you know, in your free time over the holidays, it's just, you know, go out to this, you know, these websites, this website. There's all kinds of other websites to jump onto from there about these individuals. You know, go, if you're interested, you know, do some research on your own. But if you, as you look through here, you can see that the Jesuits were very active in missionary work. Tim's not here, so I'm going to struggle a little bit with this. With regard to, does anybody remember who the Jesuits are?
They're a Catholic group.
They're a Catholic group.
What? Yeah, they're a special set among.
The Society of Jesus, I think they specialized in education. So even today, you'll have Jesuit universities.
Right. And they're actually a very powerful group within the Catholic organization, or within the Catholic Church. And so there's some interesting things as we go through some of these names or some of these dates that we'll see. So, like I said, there was some work in the Far East, China in particular. Something that I found rather interesting. In 1623, and I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Zian Stili, or Stili, was unearthed. It was a monument that documented in Syriac and Chinese, or Mandarin, I think maybe it was Mandarin, 150 years of Christianity prior to the erection of this memorial, or this whatever it was, in 1781. The Jesuits tried to claim that this work had actually been done by some followers of Nestorius, but apparently that's not accurate, and they're not really sure who that was. But the thing that I found interesting is that there was 150 years of Christianity prior to 1781 or 781 AD. Why is there such a big need for missionaries in the 1600s then?
in 781, the Chinese emperor outlawed not only Christianity, but all religion.
Okay.
So, which of everything just kind of...
Which is interesting because you see in a number of places, like Japan was extremely resistant to Christianity. I have a word that...
1605.
Yeah, 1614. 40,000 Christians were massacred in Japan. And in 1624, there was an incident where 50 Christians were burned alive. So extreme resistance to Christianity in places like Japan. And you'll see in 1617, someone goes to Vietnam. In 1625, Vietnam expels all missionaries. So there were things going on in the Far East that weren't necessarily going on in other parts of the world. I don't know that I recorded anything in India, but there was also a certain amount of resistance in India as well.
So, question: 200 years later, parts of the East are more accepting of Christianity. So, was it specifically what Catholics were doing, or did something change in that, their culture or in our methodology?
Well, apparently the Chinese were fairly receptive. But the interesting thing about it is this guy in 1602, when he saw converts, he also allowed them to continue to worship dead ancestors. So I think there was a certain amount of syncretism that was taking place, especially in this part of the world. The Vatican later came out and spoke out against that and disallowed the worship of dead ancestors, which might be part of why, you know, there became some resistance there. There were two different approaches to the Jesuits and the Catholic approach to missions in the 17th century. There's the Far East and there's the New World. What does the New World look like compared to the Far East? What do you mean by that?
Well, the indigenous Indian people had not started any kind of civilization like they knew.
Like who knew?
European, you know.
Nomadic, like they were on the move, but they weren't necessarily settled. Well, that was true of the North, but in Central and South, you had the Aztecs.
Yeah, they had the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incas, yeah. And even in the Northeast, the United States, they weren't totally nomadic.
But it was sparse. People, there were very few people. I mean, some people say less than 500,000 in all of North America at that time.
Okay. So, I don't want to say they weren't civilized. I mean, they had forms of government, and they, you know, they had religions. But when you look at the Far East, I mean, they had some established religions. They had, which that's not to say that the indigenous people of North and South America didn't have religions, but you know, they had established governments. It was the it was basically the government of Japan that resisted Christianity.
Well, and the religions of Central and South America were so brutal. I mean, killing tens of thousands of people for human sacrifice. I wonder if it was such, Christianity was such a stark contrast then.
But the thing that you have to look at is that what was happening, especially for countries like Spain, Portugal, what were they doing in the New World? They were looking for gold. They were conquering, weren't they? They actually were conquering those people in the New World. Whereas what they were looking for in the Far East was trade more than anything. They weren't looking to conquer those countries. And so you have this what appears to be a slightly different approach. I mean, you have imperialism in the New World where, I mean, they're subjugating these people. And so with the authority of the Catholic Church and along with those people, you know, you send your religious people with them. And then there's follow up with, you know, the Jesuits and everything to those people. I mean, and there's examples of Jesuits all over North America, Arizona, New Mexico, Mexico, in the Northeast to the Iroquois and Algonquins. So but they're all, and that's another thing. I mean, you go to China or you go to, you know, most of those people all speak the same language. There's a Chinese written language. How many different tribes do you have in the New World that you have, you know, that you have to deal with? And you have tribes that are fighting tribes. And there are situations where one tribe, you're working with this tribe and this other tribe comes and decimates this tribe. Now your work is all for naught because, and so there's a definite difference in the way missions is approached in the New World as opposed to the Far East. There's one continent that seems to be conspicuously not mentioned.
Antarctica.
No. that one too. But I'm not sure there's any indigenous people there.
Australia.
Africa. How do you get to the Far East? From Europe.
From a boat.
What? In a boat, but in a boat. Well, how do you have to go? You got to go around Africa. And I found it very interesting. There were very few references to any missions work in Africa. There were some. There was a princess in Angola that was actually converted to Catholicism and actually implored the Pope to send more missionaries there. There was some work in Madagascar, which, you know where Madagascar is?
This is not one movie.
Well, yeah, we all know that movie, right?
Southeast Island.
It's an island, and so you probably run into that as you're on your way to the, you know, the Far East. But I didn't find any explanation as to why, other than that's not where people were colonizing at the time. They were going to the New World. They were going to North and South America. They were going to the Orient, looking for trade routes and things like that. So, obviously later, we will see some work in Africa.
So would that be because the missionaries were just following people who were doing something else?
Yes. In fact, in a number of cases, the Protestants that I saw were actually, I don't know if you would say businessmen, or they were representatives, like of the East India Company and things like that. There was actually, you know, some associations, you know, with those companies that took them there. But I think, yeah, a lot of it was, you know, as the Spanish, as the Portuguese, conquered, if you would, those parts of the world, then they brought with them their Catholic religion and basically subjugated those people to that religion. And there were others besides the Jesuits, the Carmelites, the Dominicans, the Augustinians, the Franciscans, they all had some missionary work. But by and large, as I was reading through all of these, the one thing that I found interestingly absent from their efforts as they evangelize people, because they obviously all had to learn the language of the common people or the people that they were ministering to. But none of them, I could find no example of any of these Catholic missionaries that did any work to translate the Bible. They translated other things, the catechism, other documents of the Catholic Church. They would translate them. But I could find no evidence that anybody put any effort into translating the Bible.
Into their language?
Into their languages that they went to.
Did they teach them Latin at all?
Not that I saw.
But they were Catholic missionaries. Their goal was to make them Catholic.
And
not to make them Christian. So when you say 10,000 or 40,000 Christians were massacred, that's kind of a loose term, right?
But also at that time, to be Catholic was to be Christian.
Was to be Christian,
in their,
yeah.
In their minds. Even in, you look at South America, I mean, now it's like, if you ask somebody, and maybe it was probably different now, are you Christian? He said, no, I'm Catholic. They make a distinction between primarily Christian being Protestant and Catholic. So they'll make, but at the time,
yeah.
What were the choices?
Right.
I mean, even, you know, you look at the term Catholic. You know, we probably prior to when the Pope was probably becoming more and more, or the Bishop of Rome was becoming more prominent, they'd use the term the Catholic Church. It was just a term that was used to recognize all Christians.
Right.
But their goal wasn't to bring them the gospel. Their goal was to make them Catholic.
Well, in their minds, that's probably the same thing. But yeah, if you do any research, you will find that in most cases, it doesn't talk about conversions, but it talks about baptisms. And yeah, that's how, you know, maybe the Catholic Church would recognize that somebody has been converted. They've been converted to Catholicism or to Christianity in that day, because they're willing to be baptized. The few Protestants that I found that were doing missionary work, I found that to be somewhat similar in that I only found the one, John Eliot, in 1644, a missionary to the Algonquin Indians, that actually developed a written language for them and then translated the Bible into their language. And I don't know if we're gonna cover the Quakers or not at some point, but they're an interesting group. And believe it or not, I mean, they started sending missionaries out, and there were several references to Quaker missionaries. Does anybody know? This is kind of rabbit trail. The word Massachusetts. Do you know what that comes from? You know what that is? It's actually a tribe of Indians from that part of the world. I did not know that. But anyway, the thing that struck me was the lack of, and I think Lonnie pointed this out when he covered the Puritans. There was an obvious lack of, desire to take the gospel to the indigenous people when the Puritans, you know, came to the New World. There was one reference that I found, and I don't remember, it was toward the middle of the 17th century. There was a Lutheran who wanted to know why there wasn't more Lutherans being commissioned to be missionaries in the world. And, you might want to ask the same question of, any of the other, Protestant groups. And you can see here, there's a Calvinist, there was a Lutheran, there was a Puritan, and then late in the 1600s there was an Anglican preacher.
Did these 50 Christian people get burnt alive because they were sharing Christ?
They were probably burnt alive because they said they were Christians. There was an intense persecution against Christians. It was, in fact, at some points in that period, it was against the law to be a Christian in Japan. So,
I wonder how much of Japan or Free Vietnam, is there a lot of Catholics there now left over from these missions?
I can't answer that question, but I'm not. I mean, when you were in that part of the world, did you see Catholic churches?
I think probably if you, I don't know about Vietnam, but outside of Buddhism and the influence that has, probably Catholicism would be maybe the next, but mm-hmm. I think it's probably so insignificant as far as population. It's not a big influence, but probably more than Protestantism.
I don't know how big the population is, but part of the problem with the Vietnam War was the South Vietnamese had a Roman Catholic president
mm-hmm.
who, and my impression, it's been a while since I've read about it, but my impression was that he was kind of countercultural, and that made him unpopular, which is why the North broke away.
I think one of the Lord's relatives told us that if you wanted to come to America, it was easier to do if you went to through the Catholic Church. You could get a visa easier than if you. That was his impression.
Yeah, that's his impression. Yeah, how accurate that is, we don't know. And I don't know. I mean, when you look at indigenous people in North and South America, I mean, maybe in South and Central America, in Mexico, that's, heavily Catholic. But if you look at in Canada and the United States and you look at the indigenous people there and you look at, what kind of inroads has the gospel had, in those people groups? I don't think it's very significant. And I wonder, in the fact that, and one of the things that we've seen throughout history is the loyalty that Catholics have to the Catholic Church in large measure. But what we know about a lot of Catholics is that they, number one, they don't have a Bible that they can necessarily read, because it's only been recently that the Catholic Church has accepted the fact that they ought to have Bibles in the vernacular of the people. But the thing that I'm wondering especially about the Far East and maybe some of the indigenous people in North America is, if the scriptures are what we use as a guide to life and spirituality, if you don't have that, how are you going to pass that on to the next generation? How are you going to see people grow? I mean, granted, these people learned the language and they learned how to preach the word, but I think there's a distinctly necessary dimension to our Christian life that we have the scriptures that in our hands and that we can read them. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I agree.
I didn't see anything that discussed that in my research, or you know, gave that as a, you know, as a reason. But when you look at these cultures, you have to ask the question: if there were missionaries 400 years ago to these people, you know, why didn't the gospel take root? And as I was thinking through this, and then again, did we have a missionary from South Korea? No, somebody who was here from South Korea.
Well, he was Korean, but his missionary work was in Tibet.
That's what it was. And so I asked him one time, because at some point South Korea became a missions sending country. And I don't know, somebody or somewhere I read that maybe they even sent more missionaries than the United States did. Why South Korea? And I remember talking to him and asking him, you know, why was Christianity or you know, and that's a general term. But I think that there was the sense that there was those people were truly converted in South Korea. You know, why? Why were they so suddenly open to the gospel when we have seen for centuries most of that part of the world is significantly resistant to the gospel? And basically what he told me was that they were so destitute, they were without hope, and that when missionaries brought the hope of the gospel, they latched onto it. And so, I'm not sure that I can explain why you don't see a more of a gospel impact in, especially in that part of the world, than you do today. But I think it definitely has to have something to do with the fact that they didn't at that time necessarily have the scriptures in their own language. And it was also interesting, as I've looked at Protestant missionaries over the centuries, and you know, back in Bible college, we studied a few of them. They would go to missions fields and they would stay there virtually for the rest of their life and minister there. As you read through some of these Jesuits, they would go for 2 or 3 years and then they would return home, and somebody else would go. And so there was never that consistency there either. But, you know, whether that has, you know, whether that had any impact, I don't know. But anyway, probably a little different lesson than we've had in the past. But my hope is that, you know, when we think about missions, you know, try to understand, you know, what is a missionary, you know, what do they got to go through to get there? And if you're going to have lasting impact, you know, what do you need to do? You know, we, in our day and age, imperialism is a very negative thing. Let's put it that way, to say the least, right? You know, we get accused of being imperialists as Americans all the time, and that's not a good thing. Or they say that's not a good thing, but what's that? It's not a true thing either. No, that's a different discussion altogether.
You look at the time, money, energy it takes to go into a place. You have to learn a language. Like what the ones we personally support, I don't want to mention their names because it's recorded, but you know, they had to learn one language, then they go to another place where they have to learn a second language that doesn't have a written alphabet or
right.
Something they can read. So the time that it takes them to learn the language, to learn the culture, to be able to then be with the people, to formulate an alphabet or something along that line, to be able to write something down, and then you've got to teach teach them, and then to try to translate the Bible then into that language, I mean, it's quite an undertaking.
It is quite an undertaking. And something that Kathy said earlier is understanding the culture. And something that I remember as we were talking about this, that in the Lord's Prayer, give us our daily bread. Apparently, John Eliot translated that, give us ample venison and corn.
What did that mean?
Well, that was their daily bread. They didn't eat bread. They ate venison and corn. And so,
well, even the modern translation is interesting because I think they use the word can or whatever variation that is. But that means like really good bread.
Yeah.
Whereas the bread that Jesus used would have been better translated tortilla.
Right.
But you don't want to say, you know, he's the tortilla of life.
Well, maybe you do. I mean, what does the Spanish translation? Okay.
Is that French? Whatever.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like tortillas?
Who doesn't like tortillas? I don't know. Does anybody not like tortillas?
What kind of food did they eat back then?
There were a couple numbers here. To your point about South Korea, so it says 23% of South Koreans identify as Christian and 16% Buddhist. And then in Vietnam, it was 7%. 7% Catholic, 2% Protestant, and then up to 90% are either Buddhist or the other ones that are related to Confucianism and Taoism.
Yeah.
So, obviously there are different cultures in different places, but the grip that it has in South Korea is much more evident.
Yeah.
The Koreans are an amazing group. I read a book on Korean missions, and basically, there was nothing much before the 1900s, but the late 1800s, early 1900s, missionaries went there. Like I said, found them destitute. But the other thing that happened, we have friends who are from Korea, born there and all, but they were fleeing North Korea, and as they fled, they met a group of people that were half military. Well, some of them were military that took care of them, U.S. military, and the other were missionaries that were there with the military. And so our friends are Presbyterian because they met Presbyterian missionaries, and they're very loyal to the U.S. I think two of their kids went to West Point, and, you know, very loyal to the U.S. because
yeah.
Scott, would you say at this time the Catholic Church was like they are now, that they're more dependent on tradition than scriptural faith?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, even that.
Yeah, because that's why, like I said, I mean, they would translate the catechism into the language, not the scriptures. And so, yeah, they were much, you know, in that.
Suppose if you follow the sacraments, you're good to go. You don't really have to think much about
them. Exactly, right. And I think that's, you know.
Well, that's just, if you have, I just go to Mass every week, then you're,
yeah.
You're good.
And like I said, there were cases where there was syncretism, that where they allowed the people to continue to practice some of the practices of their old religion. So anyway,
I just want to bring it back with something I listened to at least it's been a while about going back to the Korean. I was listening to one of the pastors. It was talking about the reason the Korean has sent out so many missionaries is because, going back to what we've been trying to do as fast prayer, is that they get together. One of the missionaries, guest speaker was going there, and they heard the sound, and they asked the hotel person, you know, what that sound was. It was the call for prayer. So we, as a believer, they like meet in like a stadium and pray and sending out missionaries. So I did research it too.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, they have Prayer Mountain where a lot of people go for longer stays in prayer. And the prayer movement was definitely a big factor in a lot of things like that.
Well, even like the Moravians, the famous story of the Moravians praying.
Yeah. So anyway. Any other questions or comments? Wrap it up here a couple minutes early.
like learning different stuff as we, I come to Sunday school. I get a good feeling talking about the separate language and stuff because people are from different languages. It's important to know that God has different people in different worlds that are missionaries.
Right, and you know, every tribe, tongue, and nation will be represented in heaven, and so. Yeah.
I find this interesting because Karen's husband Marty, his grandfather, they were missionaries in China, much later than
me. Sure. Oh, obviously.
I mean, this was a start when the missionaries were kicked out, but eventually God brings the missionaries back.
Right.
And Marty's dad, Hans, they were missionaries there, and they got out with the U.S. troops in World War I, or they would have been there.
Yeah. So.
A lot of the Christians, I think, fled. Well, Chiang Kai-shek was supposedly a believer.
Supposedly, yeah.
Yeah, but they all fled to Taiwan.
Yeah.
Scott's cousins, they were missionaries in China for 25 years, maybe. And they got kicked out about 5 years ago.
Yeah, there's definitely a resistance to Christianity. And in many cases, it's, you know, you can't really explain why, other than it's probably satanic in its origin.